gloves. Back to you, Hank. And as you make more and more discoveries on this subject also, please come back and tell us what you find. N1YDY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I agree with most of what you said there. I have done a lot of research, and I have come to the Drake R4 series. I'm sorry, not the R4, the Drake Twins, the R4C, and its associate transmitter, I think, the T4, of course, is the TR4. And, of course, they have the later, the TR7 series, and the 7 lines get really wonderful reviews. And, you know, then you could, of course, look at something along the lines of the Collins KWM 380 for a solid-state unit. But the problem I find is that most of my friends are interested in more modern radios, and when you look at the more modern radios and the prices that are asked on eBay and places like that, it's kind of difficult to justify it. It almost makes more sense to buy a new radio because people want so much for their older radio, and the new ones you can get a warranty. And in fact, if you buy it from an outfit like Gigaparts, they offer an extended warranty like you can see here in Kmart or Radio Shack when you buy something, and they try to get you to buy that. And so it's kind of hard to, I mean, I like used stuff, but it's kind of hard to justify that against some of the modern radios. They just don't seem to offer any value to buy used versus new. If you're asked to pay 90% of the price of new and you don't get the warranty, you don't really know the condition when you get it when you drop it. So, you know, that's why I come back to things like Drake, of course, the Collins line. And I think I hear so many good things about the older Kenwood stuff, being the hybrid radio. They have, tubes for vinyl, but the rest of it's pretty solid state, so like you say, it can get pretty beat up if somebody can fix it. One thing I don't know much about, maybe somebody has an opinion, does anybody know if the Swan line is something that's worth looking at? But just this evening, I lost the opportunity because I just wasn't convinced it was the right thing to bid on, but there was a Swan 700 on eBay that only went for $250. I didn't go for it because I didn't like the way the guy wrote it up. I wasn't sure whether it was something he knew was dead or he really didn't understand whether it worked or know if it worked or not. But thank you very much for all your input. I really have enjoyed being able to ask you these questions, and I really like the technique. So thank you very much, and one YDY will be standing by your answer about the Swan line.
Very fine, Hank. The thing that, and Eric recognized, the thing that worries me a little bit on Swan, I don't know if Swan ever got up to a synthesized rig. I think all the Swan rigs have a fully analog, variable frequency oscillator, which means they probably had some drift. Almost everybody in HF these days wants a frequency synthesizer. Let's see what Eric's going to say on this. KE2EJ, what do you think about the Swan? K2RAW. You got it, Eric.
I like that radio, but it was analog all the way. The reason why I broke in is I have something to ask you, so finish up here. Yeah, I like to synthesized radios that don't move. It's sort of the order of the day.
Yeah, I worry about whether or not it's got a synthesizer. By the way, the Drake R7 T7 series, I believe that was their first venture into almost purely solid state. The R4C, the one that had this huge performance noise blanker, was an all-tube receiver. And so that would slow some people down to use tube equipment in 2013. But if you want that high performance, maybe that's the way you got to go. If it's a normal question you're asking, Eric, there's one guy ahead of you. There's one more person on the list, and that's Joe. And if it's a point of order with reference to the use of the machine, you've got it, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, it's actually something I can demonstrate to you, which is rather interesting and a little bit mind-boggling, but try to take your other statement first, and you're already eating into the mailbag. But, let me know when you're up for it. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Very fine, Joe. And nowadays we've been bringing up the mailbag at around 9:30, which maybe we shouldn't be doing. Joe, KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
K2UPS mobile.
KTUPS recognized. And glad to hear you, Rich. Okay, maybe Joe's not available right now. We're going to take Eric in that order, and then UPS in that order. Eric, KE2EJ, you're right ahead with your demo.
Charlie, what I'd like you to do, KE2IWK2J, is to transmit on 375 and listen on 85. Do that.
And when I do that, I think you're telling me I'm not going to hear any delay because you've got that link working. Stand by, I'll do that right now. My, that's nice and noisy. Did I do all that, Eric? KE2EJ, KE2LAW.
All right, now, stand by a second. I'm going to turn another transmitter on, and I'm going to have you do the same thing again. Just let me get into this, and then I'll explain the whole thing, and then we'll see if we can try and come up with an answer. Alright, don't wait for the beep because you're not going to hear any when I do this. I'm going to drop, it's going to come on, and then I want you to transmit on 375 again. Talk on 375 now.
Roger, Dodger. K2 Romeo and P.O. Whiskey on 975375. K2RIW. Quite a bit better. 4054, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Hi, K2RIW, K2EJ. Let me explain what's happening here. Okay. We have a signal that's going from Glen Oaks to Sullivan in one direction. Listening to the fiber here. And then we have another transmitter at Sheldon transmitting back to Glen Oaks, the one that we're having an issue with. So the first time you transmit, actually, let me recycle this stuff so it'll drop out. Hang on. Alright, now it's one time out. We've got a transmitter that let's call it, to not give away the exact frequency, let's call it 902. We're transmitting 902 from Sheldon to Glen Oaks, and in a reverse direction, we're transmitting 927 from Glen Oaks to Sheldon. Now, I've got actually multiple antennas that I've tried this with, and multiple receivers. So, the noise that you're hearing is when the 927 transmitter is not operating. Let me let it drop. And when we turn the 927 transmitter on, all the noise that you're hearing goes away. Now, I've tried this with a different antenna, an antenna that is actually intended for 450, a different receiver, which is the service monitor. And by the way, on the service monitor, when you turn the 927 transmitter on, you don't see any change in the signal level or anything. So, that's kind of cool. If you look across the band with the spectrum analyzer, there's all sorts of junk happening. So it's hard to say that this transmitter is on and it's causing this receiver to pick up this noise along with the on-carrier signal. And also the receiver, if you feed it from the service monitor and check its sensitivity, it opens this squelch at about 0.5 of a microvolt. It's nice and clean. K2RW, scratch your head on that one. K2J.
On the 900 meg RF link at both Sheldon and Glen Oaks, I am assuming it is a single antenna transceiver site. In other words, the antenna is by way of a duplexer. 902 and 928 is going into the exact same antenna, transmit and receive respectively. And so under normal circumstances, you turn on a transmitter, the receiver becomes desensitized and or noisy. In your case, it's noisy when it's not. I'm going to make a guess that the noise the receiver sees is when the receiver is up to full sensitivity and you're in a very rich environment. Let's see now, even Sheldon must be a rich enough environment that when see now. 927 is Glen Oaks. Yeah. Huh. I was about to say when the transmitter is turned on, the receiver is partially desensitized, but it's desensitized by a nice 900 meg signal of your generating. Therefore, it's a quiet desensitization, but the desensitization means it no longer picks up the noisy local stuff. Great sounding theory. It breaks down terribly because I'm giving it the exact same signal strength in both cases. In one case, my signal becomes extremely noisy. In the other case, it doesn't. You just think it's happening, Eric. This can't be happening yet. It's beyond the laws of physics. K2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
I thought that would make you scratch your head a little bit. Unfortunately, I didn't have the good spectrum. I just had to say this monitor, which can only give you a window of about a megahertz, the widest spread. I suspect this is something new, because, I mean, this system has been in place and working, no problem. What I kind of guess is happening is because we are using duplex in the moment, by the way. They are 27 megahertz apart, they're 25 megahertz apart from each, 27 megahertz apart from each other. It's a good flow, so you can get some decent isolation out of it, even small cavity duplexes. And, by the way, I took the duplexer out of the equation by using a separate antenna on a different part of the building. And also by just taking the antenna line and going straight into the receiver to listen to the noisy signal. Now, if you look at the audio that's demodulated, it kind of looks like it's imposed on it, where you're getting a mixing of two signals. And it is a very broadband noise, so I'm going to drop.
Let me make a quick guess on this one. When you turn on that transmitter, that quiets everything down. You're drawing extra current. Is there any possibility that with the transmitter turned off, some critical voltage regulator somewhere is not being loaded and it's going into a crazy oscillation? Over to you, Eric.
Now, let me remind you that I said to you that not only did I use a different antenna, I used a different receiver, which was actually the service monitor. So you can take those ideas and throw them out the window.
You didn't say it, but I presume separate antenna, separate receiver, the noise is still there when the transmitter is not, the local other transmitter is not turned on, and the transmitter creates quieting. And the way that's good, because you do want to run it with the transmitter, although is that transmitter going to be on there all the time? Maybe it's only on the air when it's properly signal cued, if you know what I mean. Carrier operated relay. That's a crazy one. That's going to take some very serious snooping, as I see it, Eric. K2EJ, K2LAW. You've been working on this one for a couple days?
No, I just discovered it today. I've been away for the past couple of weeks, so I haven't had a chance to do anything. The link has been running through VOIP. Oh, boy. I turned it back on tonight. Actually, I went over to Sheldon the other day to check that out. Turned it back on and got that all night. Then today I went up to Glen Oaks and I hear it and it's like noisy. What's all this noise about? You know, I know I'm putting out a good amount of power at the other side. And then, just for the heck of it, I keyed up the transmitter. Now, you got to think of this as a full duplex length, where it's the only reason that Glen Oaks would want to turn that transmitter on is if it's receiving something. So something comes in on 2.5 or through the IRLP, it then turns the transmitter on and sends that to Glen Oaks. There's no need for it to be on constantly. It could leave it on constantly, but that doesn't solve the problem. That just makes more trouble.
It's a beauty. And I think you're saying anything coming from Sylvan, whether it be IRLP, EchoLink, or a real 975 input, in all cases, it's noisy going into Glen Oaks. If the Glen Oaks 900 meg transmitter is not turned on. Wild. So, regardless of source, the noise is there. And I sort of see that. The source doesn't matter. The source just really means where is the audio coming from. In all cases, it's going through the same Belden transmitter at 900 megs. 927, as you call this. Huh. Craziness. Okay. Does Lou... Does, let's see, you, Lou, Andy, who else can attack this one? What are the smart RF people we got around here, Eric? K2EJ, you may have to find this one yourself, K2LAW.
Somebody's trying to get in from Selden. I'll switch it back in a few minutes, so that'll work. There's a couple things with today's digital modes of transmission, my first thought is I'm receiving a TV station on top of it, and then when I turn my local 927 on, okay, I'm actually causing the front end to be desensitized a little bit. And actually, I can see on the spectrum analyzer, the service monitor, the noise floor drops a bit, and when that happens, I hear the signal that I'm interested in come in very clearly. It could be a harmonic of some digital thing like a digital TV transmitter or a COF, the under signal from an STL or an ENG truck. It could also be some kind of wideband digital that you don't see as a single carrier. You know, it just looks like noise. You really have to stick a filter in there to see it if you want to try and see it. I think it's going to be something like that. I mean, I have a cure for this all. I'm going to drop.
Yeah, how many cavities are you using in your duplexer at 900 megs? If this is the best of all worlds, it would be 9 cavities. I know that in theory, on paper, you don't need that number of dB of isolation. Therefore, I guarantee you've got less than 9 cavities. Over to you, Eric.
Now, don't make the mistake of thinking that duplexes are bandpass filters. They're not. They're band reject filters more than anything else. So you may have it peaked at one particular frequency, and then you notch it at the other frequency. But it hears everything.
But if it was a 6-cavity filter, there are 3 real cavities. Each one has got the skirts that are falling off. And by the time you get, let me pick a number, a couple of megahertz away from the center frequency of each one of those filters, and you're going through 3 of them, you start building up some skirt selectivity that's really high number of decibels, and that can help. So even though you may think you don't need that amount of isolation, I think you need that amount of filtering in this environment. You're in a very rich environment in both cases there, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, when I originally put the system together, I had the right choices of using the 902 frequency to transmit from Glen Oaks and the 927 to transmit from Selden, and something happened where I got them confused. I was having problems with the receivers, so I switched them and wound up having to listen to all the cell phone, the portable telephone chatter and all the spread spectrum that's there. So after carefully looking at the Selden site, the 902 frequency, it's pretty clean. So it's time to reverse everything and bring the 927 back to Selden and bring the 902 up to Glen Oaks, and I think my problems will go away.
It's worth a try. But in order to find something that's above threshold for the receiver and yet make it show up on a spectrum analyzer, that is extremely difficult. If this is, again, the best of all worlds, your receiver with its super sensitivity at 900 and some odd megs has got an RF amplifier, maybe 2 RF amplifiers. If you could connect the spectrum analyzer a couple of stages downrange in the receiver, so that now you can bring the spectrum analyzer and or service monitor up to full sensitivity because it's really seeing what the receiver is seeing, three stages downrange. If you made a sampling port, I think that's the way to go because you're in the environment where you connect directly to the antenna. Your service monitor is not going to see it. Over to you, Eric, KQLIW.
No, I agree with you completely, Dick, and actually, the way the 900 megahertz receiver works, it actually generates a difference of 70 megahertz, so the first IF of the thing is at 70 megahertz. It's still a pretty wide band at that point, so it's a nice place to look. It's got a nice set of balanced mixes, so the mixes are there. And, you know, that's a good place to try and find it. But what I was going to say is that, unfortunately, I didn't bring my good Tektronix spectrum analyzer with me up to Glen Oaks, and I just have the service monitor that only has a tiny little window. But I'm sure if I look between, 800 and a gig, I'll find something. Or even just sitting on that antenna and doing a whole bunch of optics up and down, I might find something interesting that lands in the right place.
That RF room on the top of Glen Oaks is a very hot environment. From your point of view, is the 900 meg receiver in Glen Oaks extremely well shielded? Could it need another cabinet around it to isolate it from the outside world, even its B-plus wiring going into it? I mean, even your 12-volt wiring going into that receiver is an antenna, and you're in one of the hottest environments in New York City, Eric, except for your broadcast transmitter. The top of that building is the second hottest place I can think of, with the exception of Empire. You got it, Eric.
Let me put it to you this way. That place is nothing like Empire, and it's nothing like the World Trade Center, you see. There are places I can tell you not to stand on the observation deck on the 86th floor because you don't want to get warm. That's not supposed to happen, but it's been grandfathered. That receiver is so well fielded, you put a Terminator on the antenna connector, and you can blast as much RF as you want around it, and it's only hear nothing.
Good sign. Okay. Good luck with your search, Eric. You got a tough one there. Rich, K2UPS, who just signed in. Where are you tonight? Are you on Long Island or in Ohio? K2UPS, K2LIW.
Dick, I got a question if you get time in 2MB.
I hear you, Barry. Rich first.
Okay, good evening, Dick. K2IW and then K2UPS Mobile. I am in Ohio and just came through, just passed a little bit east of Zanesville right now on my way back to New York. I had two comments for, I think it was Hank and YDY with his mobile antenna, what he's trying to do. And I have two places he can go to find some information. One is a website, and it's kilo0bravogolf.com. K0BG.com. There's a lot of information there about mobile installations, antennas, running power, all sorts of stuff. It's a good site. And the other one is if you look this guy up on QRZ, he's got a bunch of photographs and there's some links to a web page. I don't remember his web page, but this gentleman's call is Whiskey 8 Uniform Zulu Zulu. Whiskey 8 Uniform Zulu Zulu. Look that call up on QRZ and there'll be photographs of his installation. He does 40 and 80 meters mobile. Some very interesting vertical antennas that he's running there with very large capacitive hats that he manufactures. That was it, Dick. Just those two comments. K2UPS.
Very fine, Rich. We got every bit of it. Rich, by the way, the method you're using right now, your audio is a little bit heavy. I don't know if it's the way Eric has told and adjusted, but you could use 2 dB less audio and speak a little bit softer. Alrighty, good information. kilo0bravogolf.com. Lots of good information about mobile 80-meter installations. And go to the qrz.com site of Whiskey 8 Uniform Zulu Zulu. I do remember also, Rich N2EO, mentioning a whole group of people who just loved antique radios. I wonder, John, if you happen to remember the anything about that particular address. I'm going to go over to you first, and then Barry in that order. If you remember Rich and Tuvio's favorite site, where people would gather who are real antique ham radio enthusiasts. KC2WGB, if you happen to remember. K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, John.
Dick, I don't recall. I don't remember him mentioning that. So, go on, pick up Barry.
Okay, maybe it'll occur to somebody later. But Rich did have a favorite site of people who commiserate with each other about their antique radios, where you get spare parts, and all kinds of jazz like that. Barry, into Moon Bounce. Quite a conversation you and I had the other night about Rich. And there's some worrisome situations there. I hope it's the situation slowly improving. But I know you've got a technical question. N2 Moon Bounce. And Far Rocky Way, as he calls it. K2RIW.
Okay, real good. I just wanted to see. First of all, Richie used to discuss a place called the Antique Wireless Association. I don't know if that's the one you're thinking of. Could be. Anyway, you have on many occasions brought up the infinitely small dipole antenna. And, of course, that only applies to a dipole or a half-wave device, a vertical dipole, whatever. They can be made infinitely small. If you go to a beam, you can't do that. But I think I'm misunderstanding you. You can do it, except you must keep the space in between the elements the same. You can't change that. But you can make the elements infinitely small. Am I wrong about that, Gore?
Give that man a cigar. You understand the principle. Dipoles and monopoles can both be made infinitely small. Be careful, though. In the case of the monopole, it would only really work well with a very large ground plane, a great big sheet of metal, so to speak. And therefore, it's of not quite as much use. But dipoles, you can make them as small as you like. And if you can use low enough loss impedance matching network to re-resonate it and re-impedance match it, because as you make the dipole small, the impedance that used to be 72 ohms resistor starts going down to 1 ohm, and if you carry it real far, you even get down to a fraction of an ohm of the resistive component. The reactive component will climb up into the many thousands of ohms of capacitive reactance. And you've got to re-resonate that. And so what a Yagi is, let me drop. A Yagi is a driven element that radiates in a dipole-like manner. The fact that you made it an infinitesimal dipole doesn't matter. The antenna pattern within 4/10 of a dB is identical to a full half-wave dipole. So the dipole on the Yagi, although it's going to be a very narrow-band Yagi, you can make the dipole as short as you like. And the fact that it's feeding a Yagi as opposed to a dipole directly into space, that's a minor detail. And each one of the parasitic elements has to present a particular capacitor reactance, in case of the directors, a particular capacitor reactance at that position in space along the boom. So for the dipole, for the Yagi to have infinitesimally small elements, and the boom is the same length and the positions are the same, you'll come back to essentially the same gain within a couple of tenths of a dB. You can do that. But if you now start squeezing down the boom length, you start losing the Yagi performance. And it takes real estate. The only way you can develop an antenna pattern, let me drop. Whenever you're looking for more gain out of an antenna, you want a more narrow main lobe. You want to knock down the side lobes and the back lobe. You want directivity. You want it to start acting like a flashlight. You cannot get a flashlight-like pattern unless you spend real estate. It takes area. Two antennas side by side as an interferometer. The spacing between the two antennas determines how narrow that main lobe is going to be. In the case of a Yagi, how many elements along what spacing of the boom, what length of the boom, is what gives you that flashlight-like pattern. In the case of a horn antenna, how many wavelengths of diameter is the horn? In the case of a parabolic dish antenna, how many wavelengths is the diameter of the parabolic dish? Whenever you want directivity, pencil beam-like antenna, you gotta invest real estate. You can't get it any other way. It would be awful nice, let me drop. It'd be awful nice if I took that 28-foot diameter, Collins, can't think of the name of the company in that name.
Kennedy.
There it is, D.S. Kennedy. Let me drop. He knows exactly what I was looking for, the D.S. Kennedy Company in Cohasset, Massachusetts. He and I both owned a 28-foot dish at one time in our life. It would be awful nice if I could take the 28-foot diameter dish, which has got around 29 dB of gain at 432 as a moon-bound antenna, and if I could find some way of squeezing the 28-foot dish down to a 15-foot, a 12-foot, an 8-foot dish, and keep the exact same gain, dream on. It takes area. It takes real estate. In the case of receiving, you know that an antenna of X number of dB of gain has got to have so many square feet of area, square meters of area. It's got to really be there. And without that area, you ain't got that gain. Without that gain, you ain't got that beam width. Without that beam width, you haven't got that pencil beam. It all hangs together. So one way or another, you got to invest in real estate, except for the length of the resonating thing, the radiating thing, called dipole-like structures, whether it be the parasitic elements or the driven elements, almost doesn't matter. You say these words on 20 meters, and they're not going to agree with you, Barry. This is controversial material, even though it's in the Bedrock book. Let me drop it. Arguably the best book in the world on antennas in the old days used to be John Krause's book, K-R-A-U-S-S, McGraw-Hill, 1950, the book called Antennas, which is the second and the third edition of that. And you look at the right chapter of the Antenna Engineering Handbook by Jasek, and there's four editions of that. Each of these books that are traceable to the Bureau, and they've been around for a lot of years, they had a whole lot of peer review. You read up the chapter on infinitesimal dipole, you'll find out what I'm saying, even though it defies common sense. How can you get the full area of a half-wave dipole when you've only got 10% of the length of the dipole there? And it all comes back from the extremely high Q. As you make the dipole very short, you're now going to do a whole lot of resonant circuit added to it to bring it back into resonance. It's going to become narrowband as all hell. It's going to have an extremely high Q. That high Q means it's got a very strong local magnetic field created by all that high current bouncing back and forth. As such, it recreates that area, creates that great big E field or magnetic field around the antenna, even though your eye doesn't see it. N2 moon bounce, wait for the beeps, K2LIW in the tech man.
Okay, that sounds great. That's kind of what I thought. I appreciate that. Just want to let you know, Richie is in St. Joseph's Hospital tonight, and he was listening to the TechNet for about an hour. He had a sign-off a little minute, a couple of minutes ago, but he says hello, and he wants everybody to know, please call him. That's the other thing. And what else do I have here? Oh, yeah, antique wireless. I think that's what he was saying. Okay, I think that's it. That's great. And I will go back to my listening mode in 2MV, Rocky Way.
Very fine, Barry. Glad to hear from you, and glad to hear that Rich is on the mend. Okay, we're late, but it's time we go over to the mailbag. John, these guys with these really crazy questions you get, which are darn good questions, what kind have you gotten this week? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net, and thank you for joining us. By the way, I spoke to Richie tonight, and there's some issues, but I have his phone number if anybody desires the number to give him a call at St. Joseph's, so just wanted to let that be known. Let me let it drop, and I will go on to the first one. Okay, we have a question here from a young amateur who's interested in understanding the differential mode and common mode on twisted pairs and different types of cable. He doesn't really understand the concept. Maybe you could give him some information on that, Dick, how that is developed what the problems are with it, and how it's solved. So, some basics, but this is the information he's requesting. And I know you got that. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Dick, you didn't complain about my audio tonight. Does that mean I fixed it?
It sounds darn good. Audio is just about exactly the right amplitude. Very slightly thin. In other words, the bass is a little bit low, but other than that, that's the Barry that I know. And you sound good. Could use a tiny bit more bass, but you've got good communication audio there. This situation of common mode versus differential mode, some very important people were present at the, the awards dinner 1 year ago, or was it 2 years ago, in which the TechNet got its technical service award, and I think it was Paramus, New Jersey. Some very important people were there who were running a one-wavelength loop antenna on 80 meters, and I tried describing it to them, these two very important people, who shall remain nameless, and I got a blank stare. I could tell they weren't getting it. Let me drop. In the case of a full wavelength loop antenna, which is one of the things that K2KNB was experimenting with, Mel had built one of these things in his backyard in I can't think of the name of the place, Manhattan Beach, a section of Brooklyn, and he discovered that as he used the right kind of a network that he built, the kind of an antenna tuner, where he could slowly slide between the differential mode and the common mode of feeding the open wire feed line to his full wavelength loop antenna, he was electronically steering the beam of the antenna, electronically steering the polarization in a somewhat complicated manner. But as he operated that knob, depending on what Mother Nature's ionosphere was doing tonight, his buddy he was talking to in London, so to speak, would hear him louder or softer when he transmitted, and when he listened, he would hear the guy louder or softer as he rotated that knob. And by the way, because of the lack of reciprocity of the ionosphere obeys something called, Faraday's Law? All of a sudden, I can't think of the name of it. Faraday rotation, yes. As the signal goes from east to west on the ionosphere, the guy talking from London back to you, the signal goes through the ionosphere and twists in polarization. The guy in London, let me drop. He might be launching a vertically polarized signal to you, which maybe goes through two or three twists before it gets to New York, and then New York, you're going to see it as a horizontal signal. Good common sense would lead you to believe you start off from New York with a horizontal signal, and it's going to go back to London as a vertical, not necessarily. In the other direction, it twists at a different rate. That's the craziness of the ionosphere obeying this thing called Faraday rotation. It doesn't work the same way east to west and west to east. But once you've got this knob and you can tune it, you can do all this magic stuff. Let's see what this stuff really is when it comes to differential and common mode. Let me drop. The network that you use in your antenna tuner, your antenna feeder, for balanced line. If you're using balanced line in the full performance differential mode, the way it was designed, the way it's intended to be used, if at this instant of time, the sine wave I'm putting on that open wire line, if there's positive 100 volts on the right side and negative 100 volts on the left side during this first quarter of the first half cycle, positive voltage on the right side, negative voltage on the left side of equal magnitude. And then on the second half of the cycle, you reverse those polarities. What used to be positive 100 on the right becomes negative 100 on the right. What used to be negative 100 on the left becomes positive 100 on the right. I'm now using fully differential. If I looked at one wire to ground, I'd see a beautiful sine wave. I look at the other wire to ground, I see a beautiful sine wave. If I now use two separate oscilloscope probes, one on each wire, and I display it on a dual channel scope, I will see two beautiful sine waves that are exactly 180 degrees out of phase. The upper sine wave on my oscilloscope will start off at zero, go up during the first quarter cycle, go back to zero, back down to the three-quarter point, and then back to zero. That's the upper sine wave. The lower sine wave will be identical to it, except exactly opposite in phase. It'll start up at zero. Instead of going up, it'll go down. So you look at these two sine waves on the oscilloscope, on a dual tray scope. They're identical. They go through zero crossing at the exact same time, but one is the inversion of the other. If I pick up one trace, and if I can pick it up with my hand and then rotate my hand, I'm holding my hand horizontal, and I got the signal painted onto my hand, and I now rotate my wrist, so to speak, on my horizontal
repeater. Time out.
I rotate my wrist 180 degrees, and the picture on my wrist is transparent, and then you get the other waveform. That's full differential mode. You get the highest performance out of open wireline if you feed it that way. And to come from your ordinary coax cable connector coming out of the antenna tuner that you're using, if it happens not to be the kind that's got two porcelain insulators where it's intended to feed open wireline, if it's just one simple coax connector, then you got to go through some kind of a balancing device. The so-called half-wave coax balun, which is a U-shaped half-wavelength of cable looped back on itself, all the shields connected together, and then you feed one center conductor, and the two center conductors go to the two wires of the open wire line, and a third transmission line feeds one of those. And so when you study what's going on, you really, because of the half wavelength of coax cable in the U-shape, you're feeding those two wires equal amplitude, exactly 180 degrees out of phase. That's full differential mode. Let me drop. Now I'm going to jump over to full common mode. If the two wires of my open wire transmission line have the identical voltage at every instant, if at this instant of time the right-hand wire on the first half cycle is a plus 100 volts, and the left-hand wire during this half cycle is also plus 100 volts. And on the second half of that RF cycle, the right-hand side is minus 100 volts, the left-hand side is minus 100 volts. I look at the two wires with two separate scope probes into a dual tray scope, I'll see two identical sine waves, identical in timing, identical in polarity. You could lay one on top of the other, and you wouldn't know that there's two there. It would be identical in every way. That's full common mode. Now, I've shown you what full differential mode is. I've shown you what full common mode is. Believe it or not, you can slowly slide between the two. As I slowly change the magnitude of the two voltages that I put on the two wires when they were differential, that's one way of doing it. There's ways you can create a knob that slowly slides from one effect to the other. You could be, and there's various ways you can do it, but Mel, K2KEY, had invented a circuit by which as he rotated the knob, it was going from the differential mode to the common mode, and his full wave loop being fed with that open wire line. Let me drop. That loop antenna would develop a different polarization and a different steering of the beam. And depending on who he was talking to, there was a nice desirable position he could rotate that differential versus common mode knob. He could rotate that knob, and he could peak up that particular signal at that instant of time. And he had a different place. On the average night, the ideal setting for that knob would be different on transmit and receive. He was using the same antenna for transmit and receive, and because of the craziness of the ionosphere not behaving the same way for a signal going from east to west and a signal going from west to east, there was two different settings of that knob on the average night that would peak up that signal between him and his buddy in London, for instance. So when it comes to anything to do with phase, the average electronic engineer, ham radio operators in particular, have quite a bit of trouble understanding what is phase shift, and this is a kind of phase shift we're discussing here, although it's another variation of it. The first time you hear it, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. This will eventually be a recording on amateurradio.tv, and you can play it back a few times, and it'll make a little bit more sense. I'm reasonably sure if you Google the words common mode versus differential mode, I'd like to believe you're going to find a few articles that'll show you a graphic that'll help make this a little bit more clear. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick.
yeah, that might be a good thing for him to do, and he'd probably be able to get a little more research out of that. Now, if I understand what you said correctly, was Mel actually turning this knob in one position for transmit and then rocking it back to a second position for receive? Is that what he was doing?
Absolutely. I think in one particular case, he made a telephone call to his buddy in Brooklyn, in England, in London, and he was rotating the knob while transmitting and asking his buddy when the signal was loudest. Then his buddy in London would transmit back to him, and Mel was receiving, and he rotated the knob until he got the loudest signal when receiving, and it was two different settings of the knob. So the ideal amount of differential versus common mode open wire feeding of a full loop antenna, and as many antennas you can do this with, but that one particularly worked well, allowed him to do electronic steering of polarization and electronic steering of the beam, and therefore he could peak up signal to noise ratio. And in some cases, he would rotate the knob so that when he was transmitting, the guy in London got the strongest signal. When he was receiving, he didn't necessarily rotate the knob for the strongest receiving signal from London. He rotated the knob until he got the strongest signal-to-noise ratio from London. For all we know, let me drop.
KC2QAQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized. For all we know, there was some QRM, a guy, you know, one KC away with a strong sideband signal coming from the back of his antenna. You know, a guy in Ohio is giving him a potent signal that's interfering with the signal from London. As he rotated the knob, he could find a fancy position for the knob in the receive mode where the guy in Ohio was made weakest and the guy in London was made strongest by comparison when he rotated that knob. And so, yes, there was a different setting for transmit and receive, and he discovered that, and it worked like a charm. And as I said, I was explaining that to some very important people at this conference, and they gave me a blank stare. So with me waving my hands in the air trying to represent the two voltages, I was using my index finger on my right hand, my index finger on my left hand. And I would operate my hands, I was moving my hands up and down. The right hand was going up and down, the left hand was going up and down. And when I did that out of phase, let me drop. When I moved my two hands out of phase, that was the so-called differential mode. Then when I flipped over and made my two hands move in phase, they both went up and down simultaneously. My finger up and down represented the voltage on the right-hand wire was my right hand. The voltage on the left-hand wire was my left hand, my left index finger. And when I moved both hands up and down, that represented the instantaneous voltage on the open wire transmission line. My up and down hand represented voltage. They could see my hands moving, but they didn't get it. And I was a little bit surprised. It really is a function of the fact that the way we teach phase shift and phasing of signals, whether that be audio or RF, quite a number of people have a lot of trouble with that. That whole concept has never been made very clear in the classes we've taken. I bet you've done some of this kind of work with your antennas also, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Absolutely, Dick. Just a couple of corrections on Mel's setup. Mel had basically two antennas that he was using. He had I believe it was close to a full wavelength loop on 80 meters, and he had the antenna tuner with both common mode and differential mode adjustability, let's put it that way. He could actually basically adjust it the way that you were saying. But for receive, his antenna was a magnetic loop inside his QTH, and it was inside the ruminum. He had basically a wooden dowel arrangement, and they basically made a high Q antenna for just reception. Let me let it drop. The reason he was doing that is because, exactly as you said before, when he was optimizing his signal on transmit so that he could get the best output signal and people in London could hear him well, he realized that he wasn't getting real reciprocity on his antenna. He couldn't hear the station coming back from London as well. And the main reason was because his noise floor, when he was getting best transmit, the noise floor on 80 meters would be too high, and the signal-to-noise ratio of the signal from London would be too low, and it would be covered in the noise floor. When he used the high Q antenna inside his basement, he could literally tune up the cue of the reception antenna and then move it around on like a tripod arrangement and basically get the best received signal with a lower signal-to-noise ratio, to actually higher to signal-to-noise ratio, which was better for his receiver. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that to my attention there, Glenn. Mel was doing quite a number of experiments with very small receiving antennas on, say, 80 meters. You get a clue about this if you just take a random length of wire, plug it into the center conductor on the back of your receiver, and you listen to signals on 80 meters, and they sound beautiful. You don't get as much S-meter deflection, but they sound awfully good. You say to yourself, you know, first of all, you'll say that, gee, the receiver must be extremely forgiving because that random length of wire must have an extremely high standing wave ratio. The receiver almost doesn't care. Second of all, although you've got an antenna, a very small capture area because it's not resonating, but because the amount of microvolts you get on 80 meters is quite significant and the amount of noise you get on 80 meters, because an antenna looking at the horizon on 80 meters is looking at an amount of noise that's equivalent to something like a 40 decibel noise figure. So as long as your receiver, as bad as it may be, receiver plus antenna, as long as that combination is, let me drop, as long as that combination is below 40 decibel noise figure, it's going to work like a charm. And to make a receiver as bad as 40 decibel noise figure, when a good receiver on HF as a bench measurement might be a 6 decibel noise figure, to make it 34 dB worse than that, you've got to work at it. You've got to kill the RF stage and detune it and almost short out the input connector, if you know what I mean. To make a receiver that bad is hard. So Mother Nature is supplying you a lot of noise on the average day on 80 meters, and that's the main reason why you set up your dipole in Massapequa, where Glenn lives, and you try to talk with another guy on 80 meters with his dipole in Clifton, New Jersey, we'll say. Well, let's make it a little bit further. Let's put him in Passaic, New Jersey. I'm probably pronouncing the name wrong, but you know what I mean. If Glenn had a tall enough tower and a good set of binoculars, in theory, he could see the antenna by line of sight of the other guy in New Jersey. And the two of them transmit on 80 meters, and they almost do not hear each other. 100 watts on one end and a full half-wave dipole on the other end. You'll say, what in the world is going on? You go on 2 meters with those same 2 meter dipoles at the same location, and the two guys with line of sight are talking to each other like gangbusters. And what's going on is that on 2 meters, Mother Nature's noise is only a few decibel noise figure. On 80 meters, the noise figure is so high that the direct signal is not strong enough. You need a strong, great big reflector, the ionosphere. Unless you've got the antenna's altitude set just right, you're getting a significant ionospheric reflection. You've got the right sunspot cycle. Unless that ionosphere is there, you'll think the band is dead and closed because you're not hearing any signals over the noise. And you're getting a little bit of a clue. Let me drop. You're getting a little bit of a clue of the fact that on the average day, with a good half-wave dipole on 80 meters, your S meter is probably registering something like S3 of noise, which is a whole lot of noise. Each S unit is 6 decibels. S3 would be 18 dB of excess noise above the threshold of the receiver's automatic gain control circuit. So on HF frequencies, your biggest enemy is man-made noise, and then QRF. Whereas on HF, your real enemy is a low noise figure front end, and do you have line of sight between the signals, so to speak? And you can talk way beyond line of sight, but you take a lot of loss in the process. I wonder if you've seen it somewhat like this, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Maybe Glenn got called away, but he gave us the information. So differential versus common mode, very good thing to learn, because I've given the example of different ways of feeding a four-wave loop antenna. There are a lot of fancy audio circuits and fancy RF circuits where differential mode and common mode make a lot of sense. A push-pull amplifier, you could say, is those two transistors or those two tubes in a push-pull amplifier are running full differential mode. There are ways of running amplifiers, two amplifiers side by side, in the common mode. And halfway in between the two 90 degrees of phase shift instead of 180. Full differential mode, you can say there's 180 degrees of phase shift between the two signals. With 90 degrees of phase shift, there's a way of feeding quadrature hybrids feeding two amplifiers. It's called a balanced amplifier, and you get some huge improvements. Input signal-to-noise ratio becomes nearly perfect. Output signal-to-noise ratio becomes nearly perfect, even though the transistors themselves have a really terrible input and output transistor noise figure. Impedance match. They have a really terrible impedance match, but when you feed them as a balanced amplifier with quadrature hybrids going in and going out, all of a sudden the biswar disappears, the performance becomes great, you get twice as much power output, you get graceful degradation. If either amplifier fails, you're still on the air. And Mr. Kira Kaur, when he invented that way back in the late 60s, early 70s, it's called a Kira Kaur amplifier. This is an American electronic engineer of Japanese origin. I think he got a number of very significant awards. I think he became an IEEE fellow because of that particular invention. Very crafty. So studying phase shift and what it means is something worth putting some time into. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech minute.
KC2QIQ back with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, Dick, I just wanted to mention exactly like you were saying before that with the antennas on 80 meters and 40 meters, 160 is even worse. Polarization is a very difficult problem because the radio horizon and trying to getting a very good location. On VHF, UHF, and even the higher end of the HF bands, to get a wavelength off the ground, you can get a tower. You can put in a Yagi up at 100 feet, and you're more than a wavelength above ground. The problem with 80 meters and 160 is one wavelength to get your antenna, one wavelength above the ground to get strong polarization in your antenna, you're talking about 250 feet. The average amateur is running on 80 meters, doesn't have their horizontally polarized loop antenna at 250 feet. You can see the problem there. So you're going to have all kinds of vertical incidence problems with the antennas, lots of lobes all over the place, and all kinds of things. So everyone's experience on 80 meters tends to be a little bit different. Unless we can all get 1,000-foot towers, then that would be a beautiful thing. This way we'd know we'd at least be a couple of wavelengths off the ground like we are in VHF and UHF. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, I've got a little question there about directional antennas on 80 meters. I think you could clear it up.
Going to get to you in a minute, Barry. If you're really smart on 80 meters, you would not make your horizontal dipole the main antenna. If you had the resources, if you had a tall enough tree, tall enough tower, a vertical half-wave antenna has a lot going for it. And Mel was there also, K2KEY. He's now a silent key, and we all miss him. But in his front yard, he's had a simple piece of green plastic-covered wire hanging from his, I think it was an evergreen tree in his front yard in Manhattan Beach. Near the top of the tree, the wire was connected with an insulator. It hung vertically down. It was a half wavelength of wire. And my goodness, did that thing scream. No ground plane radios at all, per se. And with vertical polarization, you don't get that phase shift on ground reflection. You get a much lower angle of transmission. He was running 100 watts into the simple little piece of wire hanging from his tree, and people said, how in the world are you that loud? Are you running 5 kilowatts, if you know what I mean? And very few of us know that. Whenever we're studying the license manual to get your license and you figure out how antennas work, the simple dipole antenna is always shown as a horizontal thing parallel to the ground fed in the center. It's a good antenna on many of the frequencies, but when you get down to 80 meters, it's not as good an antenna as you think. If you've got the resource and you can rotate that half-wave antenna vertical, you don't need a whole bunch of ground plane radials. Yeah, vertical antennas work like a charm, and everybody thinks it's got to be a quarter-wave resonator, quarter-wave radiator, in which case they need, let me drop. If you really want high performance, you need 32 ground plane radials, and very few people do that. That need for the ground plane radios disappears. It's got a little bit more altitude, and you can make that vertical half-wave dipole. I've got a tower tall enough to do that, and I just haven't gotten around to it because I'm not an 80-meter person, but maybe I would become one that for that very simple antenna would get me some, you know, huge reports and almost as good as running a full three-element rotatable beam, as that guy in Japan has done. I can't remember his call letters. If I could, you look.